Thank you, guys. And thank you for that. You're awesome. Before I start, I wanted to welcome Mary and Taylor, who are here from his mansion, flying all the way from New Hampshire. Raise the roof. And then Doug and his family. You guys moved down here from New Jersey. Is that right? One of the stops. One of many places to come down. So apparently there's a mass exodus of the Northeast. It's cold. Too many snowstorms, right? So I don't want to spend too much time talking about our trip to Alaska, but because we did journey there and got to experience some really awesome stuff, I wanted to share with you guys a little bit. I recognize the last thing I want it to turn into is sort of every time Alberto travels, he comes back and gets into the history and sociology of the state he just visited and what the Lord's doing. But there were some really awesome things that went on and kind of wanted to share that with you guys. And Dave, if you've got a couple things you want to say, let me know. So we went to Alaska. Yeah, I've never been to the West Coast, so that was interesting. And we were so inland into Alaska that, like, that freaked me out. I didn't know which way was north. And my entire life, I've lived on the East Coast. And so it was one of those things, like, knowing where east was always, like, really important to me, like, where the beach line is. Like, I always just had to know that. Well, yes, it would be to my left at this point. But I just remember kind of sitting there and going, okay, we're in inland Alaska, and it's difficult to tell which way is where because there is no shoreline that I can physically get to very quickly. And so that was just kind of like a weird thing for me. And so just a little bit of information about Alaska. So Alaska's huge, right? It's the largest state in the United States. It is larger than Texas, California, and Montana combined. If you were to split Alaska in half, it would still be bigger than the state of Texas. So you got to imagine what that does in terms of, you know, travel. You know, not to mention the climate and how cold it gets and the snow. And so that's why a lot of times you take a boat or you fly to get to where you're going, because you're traveling so far. And it also has a population of roughly 750,000 people. To put that into perspective, Orlando has about 3 million people. Four times larger than the entire state of Alaska. So you've got this very small populace living spread out through this diverse state. I believe Anchorage had roughly between 250,000 to 300,000 people. So that's like almost half of your population there. Then Fairbanks, where we were, had about 36,000 to 75,000 if you include the surrounding areas. So that's like the next largest city, and then everybody else just like spread out through all these areas. And they have such a diverse population of so many different people. You have a lot of Asians that move from, you know, the Far East from there. That's not very far. So you've got a large population of them. They travel that far. Russia, because it's right there, Russia and Siberia, like it's right there. You could actually travel during the winter months across the Bering Strait and just kind of go across into another country. That happens. That's a cause for concern. You're worried about the border in Texas. Like, I would be more concerned with, after watching all the James Bond movies, it's usually the Russians, right? You've got a large Samoan population, a growing Mormon population, because they can be secluded and kind of build their own thing. You can have a lot of cults that can live on an island and do their own thing. It's very independent, much like Florida. They love their guns. They love their freedom. They love their camo. They love their hunting. They love their fishing. And so it was just like, this is a cold version of Florida. Or any other city you travel to is stupid far. Like, and trying to leave the state is impossible. So there are those sort of aspects of it. Historically, Alaska was once taken over by the Russians that came across the ocean from that angle and actually sold Alaska to the United States. Alaska didn't become a state until roughly 50 to 60 years ago. So it, for a long time, was in this limbo period of time. They have sort of a Russian population that has existed there for quite some time. Also, during World War II, the Japanese came over and took a bunch of land in Alaska. So we were actually invaded during World War II. Yeah, that's scary, right? Like, I want the a little bit more, what was that? It wasn't a state, but we technically owned it. So it was still, like, if you can own land and people, so it's like you can still argue that it was our little piece of property that was invaded. So that's an interesting sort of scary thing to consider. As a matter of fact, most of its military base that now exists in Alaska, sort of like its missile defense systems and a lot of things like that, came because during World War II, the Japanese exposed a weak spot for the rest of North America. And so, you know, you have a lot of, you know, military presence that exists there. It had a large gold rush and oil rush industry during separate periods of time, which all created a lot of interesting dynamic of transplanted people coming to take and to build big business and big industry. So it played as an outpost for people to take resources and go somewhere else. All of this plays into the psychological reality of the way the state of Alaska plays out. For a long time, the Native American population there went largely ignored through a lot of its poverty and a lot of its struggles. It wasn't until oil was discovered on their land that the United States government chose to negotiate with them. And so there's still a lot of resentment over that, sort of like, well, we starved and died, no one cared, but all of a sudden, you know, you find resources you want, and now you're willing to bargain with us. And so now you take a largely underdeveloped, lots of underdeveloped communities in terms of literacy for a long time, in terms of financial management and those type of things, just because finances in terms of cash didn't have as much value. And then you take that same population that struggles with alcoholism and substance abuse, and you write them large checks and large chunks of money, you know, to compensate for the oil that's being extrapolated. So that further kind of spins the culture in a very interesting direction. Their experience with missionaries has been largely forced Christianity on them, you know, very sort of like the way we would imagine Christianity look like with the Native American population during the early colonization period. Very sort of, we're bringing our culture and our way of doing things. So a lot of their experience was not just Christianity being shared with them, but Americanism. They were stripped of their identity, their culture, their language. A lot of their celebrations were removed, and they were told they weren't allowed to do that. And for a long time, a lot of their kids were taken from their homes, sent to boarding school, educated, told that they weren't allowed to celebrate any of those things. It was reinforced with physical discipline. And then when they turned 17, 18 years old, they were shipped back home, having nothing in common with their family. Not being able to speak the language, not being able to share anything, like having lost that. So they saw American imperialism being expressed through Christianity. So, which is why it often is still referred to as the white man's religion. Like, it's the separation in their mind is not, there is a God, there is a Christianity that exists outside of what they witnessed and experienced. And so they see it as sort of like, sometimes it's seen as a cultural religion and not sort of the way we might see it, playing a bigger world role. So, like I mentioned before, you have a lot of substance abuse, a lot of, because of the climate, you know, it gets really cold, you can't go outside, it's harder to travel, the roads are more dangerous, every car we saw was beat up, like, you know, just because of, you know, I mean, just the extreme climate, it can get up to negative 50 degrees, if you stand outside longer than, I believe, 30 seconds, you start suffering from early stages of frostbite, it's called frostnip, your skin starts to peel. Just think about that. In Florida, we call that heat blisters. That takes a little bit longer for us, but I mean, we have sort of the extreme, you know, on the other side. So it builds up a lot of isolation, you know. During the winter months, everything slows down. People don't travel as much. People don't visit each other as much. If you're living in a bigger city, it's easier to get to certain resources. Whereas if you live in the village, a lot of these guys travel into major cities, make large purchases, have it put in crates, and then have planes fly it to where they live and drop it off. So for us, running to Walmart is very different than their experience of getting, so imagine the mass isolation. So substance abuse becomes really easy to, you know, to have a stronghold within separate communities, and it becomes a lot more difficult for the police to really police those areas when you have to take a boat and a plane to address a domestic disturbance situation. So most of the protection is entrusted among the elders and the leaders of certain villages, which most people can grow up with a very negative experience with a lot of hidden sexual abuse, physical abuse, mental abuse, that kind of thing. And so there's a separation a lot of times between sort of the natives and the local, and a lot of racial tension that continues to grow. Because it's an interesting dynamic to see sort of what is a negative, maybe resentful experience with the locals that have moved in onto the land. A lot of what most locals that have moved to Alaska might see it as misappropriation of resources. Like, these guys get all this money and they blow it on nothing. Meanwhile, I have to go to college and work two jobs to pay my way through. So it creates a lot of that weird tension of just like, why should they get assistance? They don't do anything with it, you know? As a matter of fact, at one point, I actually saw a local native who was Cherokee kind of sort of get into it, like that weird sting of an argument. You know when you sense the resentment of someone's voice and they have a quiet argument, you know, a couple words, and you're just like, oh, that's awkward. You know, a lot of this information we didn't find out until the end of our trip. So I'm sitting there asking one of the natives there. I was like, hey, man, what nationality are you? And he was kind of explaining a little bit, and he just says, he's like, I'm really a quarter native. I'm Cherokee, but I do have my card. Kind of explaining like, hey, we are assigned numbers that validates that we're enough Native American to receive whatever stipend is owed to us or whatever. And one of the young ladies that was sitting there didn't know that I knew the benefits of the card. So she goes, yeah, it basically entitles them to a bunch of free money that the rest of us have to work for. Boom, just like that. And the kid goes, I'm sorry. Like, what do you want me to do about that? Like, there's nothing, and you could just feel it. You know, that regardless of the progression and the development, there's still that tension. You know, the natives carry that stereotypes of, a bunch of alcoholics that have never moved past their hurt. You know, some of the people that have moved in can be seen as insensitive, and they don't understand, aren't really there to help and really support. So there can be a large division just between those two major groups, the Americans that live there and the natives have been there for a while. The isolation adds to that. There's not as much of a sense of community, that kind of like exists there. Most people who live in Fairbanks dream of leaving. even though the university is thriving, has a fantastic education, UAF that's there, University of Alaska Fairbanks. Thank you. Federation? I don't know. I spent the time there and didn't bother to remember what the F stands for. So even though the school's really good and they offer like a lot more affordable education, a lot of people don't want to stay. They've got a metropolitan area like their downtown with skyscrapers or large buildings or whatever. Like, so you can see that there's room for growth and industry and that kind of thing, but no one wants to actually stick it out. So it's interesting to kind of look at sort of all those dynamics play a role with one another. And so when we started the conference and we were down there, the first night of the conference, I asked three questions. I said, I asked everybody what churches they were a part of, what ministries. And they all said, oh, I'm a part of this church, I'm a part of that church. And then I said, okay, can you tell me something about Fairbanks? I'm new here, I would like to know. And I was really measuring what they gravitated to mentioning. Oh, this is really good, this is really bad. Mostly negatives is what I got. And then I asked the question, will you tell me something that you believe for your city? Crickets. And then someone says, what do you mean by that? I said, well, could you just tell me something you just believe God is going to do in your city? Crickets. And you hear a couple people kind of mumble to each other and kind of ask a couple, And finally, one of the guys speaks up. He is the worship leader at the largest church in Fairbanks. It's called Friends Fellowship Church, something like that. They call it Friends. And so it's about a 700 to 800 member church. And he says, can you give us an example? And I said, okay. I said, so our community, like most, has many denominations, many different people from all walks of life. So, of course, we have the diversity of just all these people from different backgrounds, and there's not always a lot of communication between churches. But there is a history of Christianity within our community that if you've been there long enough or if, you keep your ears open, you'll hear names like Tabernacle Church that was in the area, a lot of what God did there, some of the prophetic vision and direction. And so many of us who have heard about the stuff or grew up hearing those stories kind of carry on a lot of those stories and remember some of those things that happened. So you might say, because there was a central church in our area that a lot of these other churches were planted from, they carry some of that over. I said, of course, like, we're not saying every church or every, area, but if you look at the history of Melbourne and Palm Bay 50, 60 years ago, you'll hear this story and where a lot of all these things, even Church on the Rock came from the Tab, Zion came from the Tab, all these other churches. So I said, so in a sense, I guess you might define that as a prophetic history, maybe, like an experience people had with God And they shared that with their grandkids, and people just remembered it. So when it got to my age group, and we and our youth group was working with a lot of these local churches who knew about this stuff, we would talk about it and believe for revival and believe for young people to get saved. And so in a sense, you could have asked us, what do you believe God will do in your city? And at 17, 16 years old, we would have said, man, God's going to save the youth, and he's going to do this and he's going to do that. And we heard that these things have happened before. So we could have said those things. And they all just kind of go, what? So I said, okay, well, forget about your history. What do you believe now for your city? What? Like, grow the church, right? Like, you know what I mean? You want people to get saved, right? I'm like, yeah, sure, but does anyone here believe that there's a future for Fairbanks? And I'm like, and that God's going to do something. And they were like, well, we get it. Or it's just, I guess I've never thought about it. And it was just crickets again. Everybody went silent. I'm like, okay, there's nothing wrong with not having that question answered. Maybe over the course of the conference, we can look at that and see what that might look like. And so on the last day of the conference, I asked all the same questions. You know, I said, you know, tell me something about Fairbanks. And I said, tell me something you believe for your city. And at the end of the conference, suddenly you heard people go, we need a community center so that everybody during the winter months can work together. Maybe we can have an ice rink in there, maybe a pool. And then we also have a tennis court. And then we can build, you know, a garden and everybody can hang out. Yeah, I want to do that, you know. And suddenly you saw people being creative and believing for something and wanting to see a future for Fairbanks, despite the fact that a lot of them recognize that they may not be there for another 5 years. At the very least, they were willing to go, okay, if we were, this is what we would want to see. And so it was really interesting because I realized like how almost normal it is for us to talk about that sometimes. What do you want to be in 5, 10 years? What's some of the things we want to be connected to? Whereas in other areas like them, you know, that isn't a commonplace, right? And so that was one of the unique things, you know, coming, you know, away from it. And one of the things tying it into just City of Refuge, I kind of asked about the music scene. I know they do shows over there and concerts and stuff like that. And so just kind of interested just because the hosts that were taking care of us is an organization called Joel's Place. It's a skate park parachurch ministry that's ran by sort of like the community funds it a little bit. There's not a lot of emphasis of churches really supporting it as much, which really, really sucks. And they, you know, had us come out and spent time with us. And so because they do, you know, they work within the skating community and the music community, I kind of asked those questions. And so they explained that, like, the local worship leader was probably, like, the head guy when it comes to music. Like, if people want to do something within the community, that's kind of the guy who's really talented, is a great singer, knows a lot of the musicians. And so, you know, I shared with them the example. I said, you know, building a community and influencing an area of a sphere of influence is as simple as developing a community within that sphere, right? It's as simple as the guy who might be the most musically talented collecting all these musicians and saying, let's hang out and spend time together. Let's just hang out. And let's be creative, and let's spend time together, and let's just play. And then from that, you begin to develop bands, you begin to develop, you know, music that comes out of that, and more people come. And I said, I'll give you a perfect example that happened in my own hometown. I said, there was a guy named Josh Benfield who had a dream to do concerts and shows in our local community. And so he connected with a local church, the TAB, at the time, People Destiny Now. And he said, hey, will you give a space so that I can bring in these bands? And at the time, there were a bunch of, I'm sure, just crummy guys from like that weren't that talented coming together. But over the course of the next, like, I don't know, 8 years, so many bands started coming in through there, so many musicians, that we started building quality bands that were actually on MTV later on. Bands like Under Oath, Amberlin, that began to actually travel and get touring and that kind of thing. And so by the end of it, we not only had Little Reggie's, which became Josh Benfield's organization, doing shows every Friday and Saturday, our church started doing shows quarterly. Then we had Melbourne Community Church on Stack Boulevard doing shows every Friday night. Then we had local community centers opening up their door for shows. And then later on, Church on the Rock joined the scene doing the same thing. And I'm sure there were other churches doing that as well. But that just goes to show you, one guy goes, let's build a community. All of a sudden, we have a scene, and everybody can go to a concert every weekend. And your band can get exposure. And suddenly, bigger name bands had a reason to travel down to Melbourne. It's easier just to do a show in Jacksonville and leave than to go, do I want to travel 4 hours into the state to do one concert and then travel all the way back out? And so there was a reason to come out. Well, we've got Melbourne and there's Orlando. Can we do something down there? And when suddenly little Reggie stopped doing shows, it all dissipated. You know, even as a church, we didn't do as many shows anymore. And so the music scene kind of quelled down. And now when people ask me, or I see a lot of these kids with gauges and they go, hey, I'm new in town, I'd like to go to a show. I'm like, you're going to have to go to Orlando. There's no longer a community of musicians that are building that. And truthfully, had that momentum stayed, or if it's ever built again, and it's centered around Christians that are willing to influence that community, do you understand the draw of musicianship the church would have? It's exactly what Bethel and IHOP and any of those places do. They get a bunch of young people who love music, and they get Hillsong did the same thing, and they collect them all together, and they hang out, and they spend time together, and all they do is play and practice. And over the course of time, they produce tons of CDs, and it becomes the place to go to for that. And I was like, Fairbanks could be the same way, man. You just pick a thing, and you build a community around it. And so it may not grow as rapidly as you want or whatever, but it happens. And then you begin to celebrate other communities. One of the unique things, and I was just thinking about this and just started to list a few, that our church has been able to do, just to give you a picture of that, is you look at His Mansion. We've got two people from His Mansion here. His Mansion is an organization in New Hampshire, as most of you guys know, that a couple of our friends were a part of. They come down here and they talk about it and share with us about their experience. And suddenly a family within our community goes, I want to be a part of that. So they move up there for 2 years and commit. And then before that, we had Chelsea, who was a part of His Mansion, and other people who started going. Then people started visiting. You know, my family and I traveled a couple times up there. Then the Coxes went up there. And all of a sudden, what started off as just some distant community that we knew nothing about is getting missionary support on a regular basis. And you hear the name His Mansion more often. And it didn't just stop there. You know, you start looking at what we're doing with Rev Reality, Tommy Green's ministry. He comes down here, we build a relationship. It's natural. A lot of people hit it off. A lot of people don't, whatever. Then we start seeing doors open up to go to Alaska, the UK, all these other places. There are people that go, hey, I'm interested. We went to Alaska with Christy Bauman from Haiti, and they loved her. Dave and I just sat there, and we're like, oh, okay, we're nobodies, like, whatever. Like, I'm not the main speaker. That's cool. Whatever. That's fine. No feelings hurt here. I'll let my bitterness go. Like, I didn't travel this far, and I'm the one on the, no, just kidding. And I love that because she was a teacher, and a lot of the ladies that were there worked in the school system, so they loved Christy. And so now next year, if they don't invite Dave and I, they might invite Christy. And suddenly you begin to see that we begin to transplant, and we begin to just cross-pollinate people with different giftings and talent, supporting other communities in other areas, and a little church of like 50 people is suddenly on that map and becomes a stopping point of community and culture and being able to build those type of things. And I told them, I'm like, listen, it's not that Melbourne's further ahead than you guys, because I asked them, do your churches do anything together? And they're like, well, like once a year, maybe two churches do a Christmas special. That's about it. I'm like, yeah, that sucks. Like, I'm like, we at least do a little bit more than that. I can tell you about four pastors' prayer meetings that go on in any given week, or luncheons that at least feature seven or eight churches, or the Presbyterian churches that are getting together and spending time with. Like, you could at least sort of go, okay, we've got a few, not just two churches got together to put on a play. And so I said to them, I'm like, I'm not selling you a bill of goods, because a couple of them were like in disbelief. Is this just hype? Does this really happen? Like, yes, it does. We could at least help you get to 10. After 10, we've never been there. Like, that's like no man's land for Melbourne. Like, I don't know what 12 looks like, but I know what 10 looks like. And so it becomes the encouraging, like, man, there's more, and we can build, and there's a reality of people coming together if we're willing. We serve Malabar Baptists with their, every time they do their country fair or their quarterly night of worship, and we just join in. My wife and Neil and Valette and a bunch of people were traveling to Orlando when the Orlando House of Prayer had no musicians to do the 24-hour worship. And these were people forking over their own money for a two-hour commute there and a two-hour drive back. They spent more time in their car being car sick than they actually did on stage leading prayer. but it was worth supporting and it was worth building a community around. And so you begin to realize, like, wow, like, you can do a lot when you're willing to share your people, your resources. And so it was a really unique experience as we look forward to planning for California, UK, and Salt Lake City, and inviting more people, like, hey, come be a part, because if you click with someone, then go do that. Like, I want to unleash people into their destiny and their calling and their vision, whatever that is. And for our church, we get to be a part of that celebration. So, like, you know, I told them, I'm like, we're almost at the center, in a sense, of a larger community locally, because we just like supporting. You know, Kristen is always in the lead roles over at Faith Fellowship. And Jesse's always playing like a drunk or... he did play rapist in the last play. Yeah. So we were joking around. We're like, they're always in these lead or supporting roles. You know what I mean? And it just becomes really interesting. You know, Ben and Annie help out with the Cocoa Village Playhouse. You just begin to see that sort of celebration of our current, you know, art district, community, that kind of thing, and being a part of that. Which brings me to my sermon. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. Like, so you guys got another hour, right? So if you saw my video, how many of you guys saw my lame YouTube video I put up about my little devotional thing? Thank you, two people. yeah, my sister-in-law. Yeah. And so it was, I'm messing with like videography and that kind of thing. And so I put up a little devotional of something that meant to me. And I'm glad you guys didn't watch it, because then it can sound as like it's new, right? Then Valette and Chelsea are going to go to sleep right now. So feel free to tune out for the next like 10 minutes. So 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, starting in verse 7. We don't have to project, it's not a big deal. I hope everybody has their iPhones.
Yeah.
Cool, awesome. Android, whoa, my bad. Android, anybody actually using a Bible? This is just for show, so I can still be accepted among the Bible-carrying crew. I carry my Bible too. What translation? No. So 1 Thessalonians is an awesome, awesome book. The whole Bible's good, but if I could recommend a book of the Bible, I would say 1 Thessalonians. Here's why. The church in Thessalonica was a largely Gentile church community. Sure, they had some Jews that had converted to Christianity, but they were mostly Gentile living in a pagan culture, and they had a lot of persecution going on. A lot of persecution. And Paul really connected with them because he was experiencing the same level of persecution every time he visited Jerusalem among the Jews that were there. And a lot of times when he traveled through Ephesus and Corinth and a lot of those other cities, but he was experiencing the same level of persecution and the same level of hardship, and he was able to relate to them on that. Like, man, I know what it's like to be afraid about going to the local market. I get that. I understand what it's like to see a friend travel and wonder, will he make it outside the city limits before someone attacks him? Like, I understand that. And so he had this awesome connection with the church in Thessalonica, writing these great letters, just going like, I love you guys. You guys are awesome. I get it. Like, it sucks. I'm so sorry. Like, I'm going through it too. You know, but hang in there. You know, hang tough. And hang tough. Quote by Paul, right? I don't know if that's New King James or NIV, but... The message, right? Hang tough. Hang tough. And so starting in verse 7, I feel like it really gives us a picture of what his experience with the church in Thessalonica was. And in my translation, which I believe is NIV, it starts and says, just as a nursing mother cares for her children, so we cared for you because we loved you so much. We were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well. Surely you remember, brothers and sisters, our toil and hardship. We worked night and day in order not to be burdened to anyone while we preached the gospel of God to you. You are witnesses, and so is God, of how holy, righteous, blameless we were among you who believed. For you know that we dealt with each of you as a father deals with his own children, encouraging, comforting, and urging you to live lives worthy of God, who calls us into his kingdom and glory. In some translation, the first verse says, as a nursing mother gently and tenderly nurses her child. He uses the image of a mom exposing herself in a vulnerable position to feed her young. As his what he found comparable to his relationship with them and his time with them. He didn't relate to them as an apostle. He didn't relate to them as from a title or a position. He didn't relate to them as someone who was owed something. He didn't relate to them as a boss or an employer or as someone who was telling them to do. As much as he said, I was like a mother to you, man. And later on he says, as a father deals with his own children, and he continues to speak in that tenderness, and he supports it saying, we comforted you, we encouraged you, we urged you to live lives worthy of the Lord. That's his connecting point with these guys. It was a significant relationship that meant something, that mattered to him. It was important to him that they related. And he said, not only did we share the gospel with you, but our very lives. He said, I didn't show up and preach the Bible and go back to my hotel room. And then showed up for the next session, preached the Bible, did some ministry time, and went back to my hotel room. He said, no. I was there when your mom got sick. I was there when she became a single mom. I was there when he got cancer. I was there when their marriage was falling apart. I was there when that kid couldn't read. We were there. We supported you. We spent time with you. We ate with you. We wanted to make sure that we weren't a burden, so we did everything we could to, you know, pay our own way so we can make it, which is the model that we use when we do, and as you guys travel with us and some of you guys who have, that we use. We want to pay our way. We want to figure out a way to make it as easy as possible for these communities that don't have anything to be able to have someone come out and support them and encourage them. We made sure that we had enough time to get to know who they were. Like, that was a big thing. Like, we want to know who you are. What's your story? What's your history? That's where all that information came from. Lots of questions of, like, why are there Russians? Like, which didn't get answered till the end of our trip. Like, oh, they invaded. Thank you. You know, I get it now. You know, why did this happen? We even got to travel. We traveled 2 hours to have lunch with one of the families that were just sort of supporting the mission out there. And we just spent time with these guys and ate with them. And you can tell, like, the dad and mom were excited to have us there. Like, come sit with us. Like, you know, here, have some food. And we're just, like, learning and asking questions. You know, we saw the opportunity. We even got to go, you know, on the radio in an area where it's difficult to travel to some of these industries. Everybody has a radio. Their radio station is so close to, like, Russia and stuff that they get their signal there. So they get letters from these Siberian nations hearing the gospel preached there. So we just went, stopped by the radio station on a whim to say hello and check it out. And they're like, you have to be on our station tomorrow morning. And we're like, can we do that? Like, you know, can we go out there and be a part of that? And so you can see the invitation, these people who want to know people and be known. A state that has the highest suicide rate is based on a people who are unknown. They know no one, and their struggle is not known. And the isolation creates that. In our community, how many people, you know, whether in nursing homes, in high schools, whatever, are not known? Our greatest desire is to be known, to know. God says that you would know me, that the hope of glory would be known. When he talks about the parable of the sheep and the goats, he says, be gone, for I never knew you. Despite doctrine, despite ministry, despite success, to be known is his desire. That's where guys like Greg Boyd gets a lot of their theory of a God who wants to be known outside of his preeminence, outside of his ability to be all-knowing. He just wants to know you as someone meets for the first time. That is his desire. And the way we have treated ministry in the past is just to be distant. Revere me, respect me, admire me, but do not know me. Do not know my struggle. Do not know the issues going on back home. Then to be open and vulnerable and say, yes, my wife and I are fighting. We don't know what to do. Yes, we're struggling with our kids. We don't know how to address this. And to be known and to be vulnerable and to be connected. I always appreciate your response. We're like, we're fighting? No. Like, I'll email you. Yeah, I'll email you about my problems. No. I'll Facebook you. So it's that reality, like, to know people, and that would be the cornerstone of everything we do. I appreciated Jacob and Crystal. Like, Jacob worked a ton of hours to save up money so that they can travel to his mansion and personally be connected with what was going on up there and work for a month. You know, I appreciate Kristen Wallace volunteering her time for Amanda's foundation so that she can work and serve these people. It becomes this reality of, like, will we be a generation that seeks to be known? I remember Tommy defined it as the difference between the significant and the sensational. And we're living in this culture that's at this knife point between what's significant and sensational. A sensational moment is you pray for someone and they're healed. A significant moment is someone cries on your shoulder. and that we serve a God that does both. It is the very issue that Muslims have with Christianity. God wants you to cry on his shoulders. That's sacrilege. He doesn't have time for that. He's doing God stuff. Where Christianity celebrates those moments. No, like Chelsea said, tell me you want this back and you're struggling. I'm okay with that. Like, I'm willing to hear that. I'm willing to serve you to that capacity. That we are a church that seeks to live that reality out, to know and be known. You guys heard the story of hanging out with John from the UK. I'm sure you guys. Yeah, I love the fact that here's this kid that was very mature in his faith and spent 5 days with a group of Christians from Florida and then goes back home to the UK and starts praying and healing for people, healing people. That wasn't something we imparted, you know, by the magic of the Holy Spirit. You know, like, it was something that was ignited from being known and the desire to know others. And so will we be a people that seeks that reality? I want to have significant relationships that mean something to me. I want others to have significant relationships. I want to operate in ministry out of that capacity, that people get to know each other and that's celebrated. So that it's that men and women aren't elevated, but the relationship, the community, and the God that dwells and excels in that community is celebrated. One of the unique things to kind of measure that capacity that has been sort of studied over the last 15, 20 years, and it's been sort of refuted by the intellectual community, having a tough time accepting sort of this new school of thought that's been presented really since the early 90s. It's the idea of EI, emotional intelligence. So like you have IQ. It would be, the other term for it would be EQ, you know, an emotional quotient, yeah. And the idea behind, you know, sort of this school of thought is to separate the reality that you have people that are very intellectual and you have people that can really understand emotions, and to separate the two. And to say, you know, a lot of times we kind of add the attribute of someone being really smart if they're good at communicating. And they're saying that's not the case. People with high IQs can struggle with communication and have a very low EQ, you know, and acknowledging and recognizing that EQ is a separate thing, that people do have the capacity to connect and read emotions. The three things celebrated with EQ is the ability to understand what you feel, catalog it, control it, understand what you're feeling, be able to read what someone else is feeling, and being able to communicate within those emotions. Where you might have someone that walks into the room and words just fall out. And it creates a chasm. And you're like, why would you say that? Like, what's the big deal? And you're like, you don't say something like that. You know, like, it's the reality that it has nothing to do with, you know, IQ. And what a unique thing in a time where in the church, being known is being set at the sort of the forefront of the way ministry should be done, that the world is beginning to investigate what does it mean to get to know someone and understand their emotional state and what they're going through. What does that look like? How do we measure? And just to share some brief information with you guys, just the definition of what emotional intelligence is. It's the ability to monitor one's own and others' emotions, to discriminate between different emotions, label them appropriately, and to use emotional information to guide thinking and behavior. There are three models of EI, the ability model developed by Peter Salovey, and John Mayer, which focuses on the individual's ability to process information, emotional information, and use it to navigate social environments. The trait model, as developed by Konstantin Vasily, encompasses behavioral dispositions and self-perceived abilities and is measured through self-report. And the final model is the mixed model, is a combination of both ability, the trait EI. It defines EI as an array of skills, characteristics that drive leadership performance. You know, you see that kind of guys like John Maxwell puts out a book and he begins to describe leadership and it's all EI. It's like, how does someone read a situation and sort of begin to steer it in a particular direction? Studies have shown that people with high EI have greater mental health, exemplary job performance, and more potent leadership skills. Markers of EI and methods of developing have become more widely coveted in the past few decades. In addition, studies have begun to provide evidence to help characterize the neural mechanisms of emotional intelligence. So there's this whole school of thought to say, what does it mean to know and be known by people? Like, what does it mean to be tender and gentle and to be joyful with an individual? What does it mean to, operate within those realms of sensitivity to people where we see a God who gives us those fruits? That says manifestations of my spirit are love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, and kind of moving into those things, our ability to interact with other people and get to know one another. And in our generation, and I was asked this question during an interview yesterday, the question was, and I don't know what this had to do with my interview, what's wrong with your generation? I'm like, okay, this is a test, like to see if I agree with your stance. And I said, well, he goes, you guys don't value hard work. You guys have no respect. You guys struggle with loyalty and respecting your elders and having long-term relationships, that kind of thing. And I said, well, I guess the biggest issue that I would look at in our generation is we are the largest generation that has ever existed that has grown up as predominantly fatherless. So we never saw mom and dad work things out and respect one another through that model. So on top of not seeing sort of those healthy models of many people growing up without a father, we saw many marriages fall apart, statistically the largest divorce rates of any American generation. So you see the very basis of emotional health and relationship and knowing and being known and emotional maturity being developed in the family unit completely taken apart. And then you wonder what's wrong with us. Like, dad never respected mom, he hit her. So when I get mad, I hit. Mom always undermined dad and talked down to him. So that's how I speak to other people. And you see those things play out. And so in our generation, we see a generation of people. And let me remove some of these things of like lack of education. You know that statistically, we are the highest educated generation to have ever existed in the United States. There are more college degrees that have been handed in the last 10 to 15 years than has ever been handed before. That's why college fees and Sallie Mae and all those things are household names, because all these kids are going to school, they are receiving an education. So like it has nothing to do with intellect as much as it's an ability to relate and to connect with people. And so I said, I'm not surprised that a generation that struggles identifying their emotions, navigating in their relationship with other people, trying to be understood and understand other people suffers the most amount of misunderstandings. Racial divide, social divides, class division, like people polarizing into political parties. So there's a separation with, idea groups being developed to kind of foster and shelter all these people that are trying to understand what they feel, what they think, what they understand. The misunderstanding that our generation hates the gospel when maybe sometimes it's the methodology that we're confused by and we misunderstand. And it's amazing to me that we see a God who's responding to that by trying to reinstitute the reality of being known. Creating leaders that have the emotional capacity to hear someone scream at them and hear, you're hurting. I'm so sorry. Let me help you. Who have the ability to retain their own emotions and go, I'm upset, but you need me. How can I serve? That is what is being reinstituted in the church again, saying, even seminary schools that are going, let's stop worrying about some of this other stuff we're teaching, complex end times theology, and let's focus on emotional health, like staying married, because that doesn't seem to happen anymore, and beginning to bring about those things. And as we begin to navigate and understand, and you look at a guy like Paul who called, in 1 Timothy, he calls Timothy his true son in the faith. I can give you examples of times where Paul was in these very difficult situations and he could read the emotional state of everybody that was in there and play within those roles and understand this guy's frustrated, they're angry, this is what's clashing. When you see him being tried before Cornelius, or not Cornelius, but the Roman governor that was in Jerusalem, he identifies who was a part of the Pharisees and who was a part of the Sanhedrin, and he was able to get these two guys to fight each other and back out of the situation. Because he could read the emotional tension and the emotional, frustration that existed there. He was a guy who could understand people's hearts. And to me, it's sort of like that apostolic model of not just building ministry, but building people, building community. that is sort of being re-gifted to the church. And so at 7:35, I will end with my final story. Again, people who have been hanging out with me for the last 24 hours are going to hate me. Neil identified it correctly. If you hang out with Alberto, you know what he's going to preach next Saturday. Like, I process verbally and out loud. Like, that's the way I think. And so we studied this actually in school for this past class, just kind of talking about some of this stuff. And one of the great examples that was given in my class that absolutely like blew me away, and I'm going to try and regurgitate it to you guys, but there was so many dates and information that it was really hard to like pull the core, you know, the core story out of like all this information given to us. But there are two famous physicians that have existed in the last 400 years that are celebrated for some of their advancements in what we might define as common sense within the medical field, right? Things like washing your hands and things like blood is pumped from the heart. Things that our kids understand are things that once was misunderstood. And so I'll start with the first guy. In 1846, there was a Hungarian physician by the name of Ignaz Semmelweis. I can never pronounce these names. He was working in Vienna at a local college and a local hospital. And back then, the medicine was, like today, still largely practiced, and there was a lot of sort of innovative ideas that were being presented. And when Semmelweis was working at this college, back then the birth rate or the survival rate of mothers at giving birth in a hospital was that 1 in 6 mothers would die. And for mothers doing home births, the rate was a lot lower. Like, there was more of a survival rate. And what was believed back then, that this was based on some kind of germ or some kind of air, you know, some disease that was aerial that might have existed more in hospitals. And they really didn't look at their methodology. They just said this was sort of the state of the way things were. And the two biggest symptoms that were discovered was when an autopsy was done, they would notice this white pus that would come out of the body. And the smell of putrid flesh were the two sort of distinct, you know, things that could be checked out post-mortem. And so one day there's a physician who is performing an autopsy, and he cuts his finger during the autopsy. Doesn't think much of it. And 2 days later, he dies. And they perform an autopsy on his body, wondering if maybe he caught the disease, wondering how did it come up air, you know, like, did he breathe it in? Did he ingest it? Where did it come from? And they discovered the pus and the putrid flesh. And Semmelweis, having discovered that a local physician had cut his finger during an autopsy and died 2 days later, started investigating, collecting all this information, trying to figure out this pattern, and quickly discovered that these men, these doctors, were transferring this infection into the women that they were delivering the babies out of. Because washing your hands was not a common practice. And so he sort of did limited research, gathered that information, and began to rant and rail about washing your hands, saying, this is an issue, this is a problem, we got to wash our hands, we are killing people. You got to imagine that that was a tough pill to swallow for the people that were working in the hospital, saying, you're saying that the doctors here who work diligently are killing people. And of course, the head professor of the school, Johann Klein, you know, really, you know, sat down with Semmelweis and said, man, you got to slow down. You're freaking people out. You haven't even proven that this is true. And he goes, yes, here's some of the limited information I've gathered. You have to listen. We are killing people. We need to stop. We need to start adding these procedures and change, you know, the way we do things. Johann Klein said, no, until you find further discovery, like, we're not going to change anything. We have years of practice and process and procedure, and it doesn't change overnight because some kid comes to our school, does pretty well, discovers one thing, and thinks that that's the way things should be. Semmelweis saw that as arrogance and pride, and him and the head professor started clashing. Neither of them showing mutual respect, neither of them understanding each other's position. They each grew angry and bitter. Semmelweis gathered a group around him as he taught and learned more about washing your hands and preventing other diseases. More and more younger doctors were coming up to his aid and rallying behind him, saying, Semmelweis is wise, he knows what he's doing, he should be celebrated, and he should be the headmaster. The more that position pushed, the more Johann Klein, he stuck his foot in the ground and said, no, I'm not going to let some kid that shows up at our school with limited information and starts making accusation, wrong or right, try to change the way we do things here. We have process and procedures for a reason. And so all the older doctors rallied behind him. And the clash continued until one day, Semmelweis just got tired and left. Just got tired and moved to Budapest and started a clinic there. Of course, this injured all his followers who had supported him and said, man, we've got your back no matter what. They felt abandoned. And for years, they said to him, you need to publish your studies, what you've discovered. You need to explain it to these guys. And he's like, I'm not going to explain it to these monkeys. Like, they won't listen. You know, so he grew further. And finally, he just leaves. And these guys felt empty and without nothing. Like, we supported you. We had your back. So Semmelweis moves to Budapest, starts a clinic, and now he has the power and control of changing things. So he starts, you know, laying out these processes and these procedures, a lot of restriction, a lot of sort of legalism and everything they do, which a culture back then really had a tough time adhering to it. I mean, just spending limited time in Haiti, telling someone to wash your hands could be a revolutionary idea. You know, and he's going through this whole list of everything you have to do. We need to wear two gloves. We need to start doing this. And so the more he began to learn about this stuff, the more he grew frustrated and bitter. His experience really got in him. The more he became reclusive from a lot of his employees, the more he sort of like, you know, hid away in his studies and sort of became a lot more distant and sterile. He started to lose the heart of the very people that would listen to him and was engaged more in the idea of people need to change, and this change needs to happen now. He finally decided to publish a book of his studies and adhere to what was once asked of him. Rather than making a short book explaining his findings, he spent 600 pages ranting and railing against the local, you know, hospitals and what they were doing. So he spends all this time telling them how crazy they were, how even the apocalyptic language in it. It's going to end the world. These guys are murdering people, and they won't even adhere to anything that's being said. And so eventually that book gained him a very bad name because people couldn't get past even the tone of the book to accept what he was saying to them. And so he was quickly fired from his clinic and died at the age of 47, poor and disease-ridden. Second person. Awesome story, right? Good night, guys. Thanks for coming out. In 1602, a man named William Harvey, fighting out of Italy, lived during a time where it was believed that the liver manufactured blood. It was sort of pumped through the heart. It traveled extremely slowly, and all the blood that was in the body was absorbed by the body. And so any surgery or any process that they operated on, the liver had to, you know, remain intact and was the primary source of life. And so William Harvey found that to be a little odd and a little strange. When he was upset by King James, who wrote the King James Bible, so King James I, eventually during his time in college, set him as the royal physician for the country. So he had sort of a level of prominence that was being developed as he operated, just kind of learning a little bit more about what was going on. He spent a lot of time doing autopsies, doing procedures, being very careful about who he told about what he discovered, making sure that everything he discovered was checked and rechecked and double-checked. He operated out of humility and operated out of like relationship. He built a lot of relationship with the students in his school, with his teachers, asking plenty of questions, you know, asking for you know, opportunity to work with them. And he developed a theory that maybe blood traveled quickly through the body and that it was the heart that was pumping it and that the liver played a smaller role in the process. Of course, it was difficult to prove that theory because the second you open somebody up, their blood travels quickly and it's explodes out of them. So it was difficult for him to really prove that theory. So he spent a lot of time just doing a lot of research, verifying a lot of information, and as he began to discover that his theory was correct, he spent even more time strategizing carefully that what he produced would not go at enmity with what was believed in the culture, but would be supported and accepted. And he knew that just publishing a book and throwing it out there was not going to do that. So he spent time amassing great evidence. He spent a lot of time working with the college, doing experiments, inviting his friends to be a part of his experiments. Like, hey, will you be a part of this? Will you help me do this? Asking his teachers, hey, I know you're a really smart guy, so can you watch what we're doing and make sure we're doing it right? And then asking questions. Why do you think that happened? What do you think is going on here? Like, asking, just eliciting these questions. So again, his relationship with them, it really drew people to ask questions, to question what was understood at that time, without pushing the boundaries and the limits of what they were willing to accept, without pushing people to the point of disbelief and frustration, and saying, I get it. This is a lot to take in, so I'm going to work with you at the pace that you operate. And so it wasn't until 1627 that he was elected to the highest position in the college. He was later the royal physician for Charles I, while he was a royal physician for Charles I, he spent a lot of time working in the royal courthouse, working with the king, asking the king questions, operating on the same level of relationship until 1628. A young man with 3 collapsed ribs and an open wound where you can see directly into the heart walks into a hospital, and he was still alive. And now he can directly look at the heart as it's operating, circulating blood through the body at the speed and pace that it does. So he had a controlled environment that he could finally prove, and he used that as his final evidence. He published his book, and he presents it to the people. He did it in a very clever way, actually. The introduction to the book, he says, King Charles, who is, you know, wise and has led his people well, just as you are the center of the royal government and all orders come from you, so does the heart dictate where the blood travels. Smart dude, right? And the king's like, yeah, I like this heart thing. Forget the liver. Who wants to be a liver? You know. And so he publishes this book. Of course there was opposition, but by then his teachers knew him well. The students he worked with knew him well. They loved him for his humility, for his patience, for the time that he took. He had volumes of research and things developed. And by the time he introduced the idea, it not only started gaining traction, but he was one of few physicians that got to see an entire school of thought change in his lifetime by the time he died. He was less focused on the revolution of change and more focused on the people he was working with. That might seem like a stretch, right? Like, what does this have to do with anything? I am truly convinced that the people that we connect with and we work with and the people of this church play a unique role in what the Lord's doing, not only in our local community, but in our nation as a whole, in this shift and change of Christianity. And we have the responsibility not only to understand what the Holy Spirit is doing and where those changes are going, we also have the responsibility to look at our past and look at the things that haven't worked and the things that will work, but we have the responsibility to take care of the hearts that we're working with. Not growing frustrated at them and losing our patience, having low emotional IQ, and responding to people out of our frustration and our anger because they just don't get it and they won't change now. And I'm so tired of waiting. But to show the emotional capacity that Christ has to love, to celebrate, to mourn, to have the correct balance of introducing new ideas, introducing change, understanding that it will be met with a level of resistance and that that's okay. That's okay. And what's amazing about Harvey is people did rant and rail against some of his thoughts, and he didn't fight back. Like, I'm not going to argue. I'm not going to waste my time. And it was that was honored. It's like he won't even defend himself. Maybe he doesn't need to defend himself. Maybe his work defends him, and his character defends him. And it's that reality. Will we be the people that operate in that level of patience? Will we be the people like Paul that is able to go into a community and able to go into our workplace, into our schools, and love well and tenderly? And love in such a way that we see the kind of transformation that will allow the Holy Spirit to change a community, and we are not at the center of it. And our time frame no longer matters. But we can see the work complete well. Does that make sense? Was that ambiguous? Oh, I'm sure it was. Did I connect the dots well enough? Any questions? Like, seriously, questions? I'll give, 2 questions if anybody has one. Good. Could you see Russia from our... No. Could we see Russia from our house? Sarah Palin. Yeah. Although you could see from where I stood to the Alaskan Range, which is about 200 miles away, 250 miles, you could like see it and you're like, that's like seeing Tampa from here, seeing Tampa. That was crazy. Yeah, nuts. Any other questions? I'll take one more. Burn it. Walk away now. Light it on fire. I would answer that by saying that I don't think it's a coincidence that Melbourne has such a diverse group of leadership and a diverse group of people with passion and vision. And the greatest enemy that we fight here is apathy, which I think gives hint to the potential of the people that live here. And that you have such an eclectic group of people traveling from all over the world that move down here, you know, and then people that have lived here for a long period of time, such a prophetic history of what can come, that I think Melbourne will be on the map one day. I actually don't doubt that at all. We totally could. I mean, if a place like Fairbanks and Anchorage, which is the same population size, like as us, and if you look at, read the map of our community, there's so much undeveloped, you know, area west of 95 and south of Malabar, that we have the room for growth. We've got the gift of people that can operate on that level. And just in the last year, the amount of travel, connection, and new businesses and nonprofits that have been launched just from this church, to me, is a microcosm of what's next. So, like, I think that reality is more unbelievable for people. So I've had to learn and am learning to tone it down and just go, good things will come. Perhaps we'll get a downtown. Maybe not. Maybe one street of downtown. Maybe we'll one day get a skyscraper. Wouldn't that be fun, you know? So I would say it that way. Like, we have immense capacity for growth. Not to mention, we have the benefit of being between Jacksonville and Miami. So we're a pretty awesome stopping point, like, for another metropolis to grow and develop. Is that good? So can I pray for you guys and let you guys go? Thank you for your infinite patience. No, I don't believe in prayer. Heavenly Father, Holy Spirit, we thank you for your creativity. We thank you for expanding our faith, expanding our understanding of just your heart. We thank you for not giving up on us. Father, we thank you for celebrating our dreams, for being in our corner, for loving us well. Jesus, we thank you for paving the way and showing us that not only it's possible, but that you are right alongside us to show us that way. Holy Spirit, may you ignite our faith, may you ignite our creativity, may you ignite our hope, and as our hearts are tethered together, supporting one another, may we see how each of us are part of that greater tapestry. May we celebrate each other's, each other being integrated into that process, and may we love and be known well. In Jesus' name, amen.